Maya hears the giggling as a muffled roar in her ears. She sits there calmly with pain throbbing through her brow and forehead, and slowly wipes herself with the few small napkins on her tray. They quickly run out. She refuses to look around for more, but suddenly someone puts a thick pile down next to her. A different hand, almost as big as her own, starts wiping the table. She looks at him and then shakes her head, almost beseechingly. "It'll only get worse for you if you sit here," she whispers. "I know," Leo says. Her little brother sits down beside her and starts to eat. In a sea of stares, he seems unconcerned. "So why do it, then?" his big sister asks. Leo looks at her with their mother's eyes. "Because you and I aren't like them. We aren't the bears from Bear Town." Chapter 37. Sooner or later, almost every discussion about the way people behave toward one another ends up becoming an argument about human nature. That's never been an easy thing for biology teachers to explain. On the one hand, our entire species survived because we stuck together and cooperated. But on the other hand, we developed because the strongest individuals always thrived at the expense of the weak. So we always end up arguing about where the boundaries should be drawn. How selfish are we allowed to be? How much are we obliged to care about each other? People say, "But what about a sinking ship? What about a burning house?" Because those are dramatic scenarios to imagine. It's hard to win a debate against that. Because if it were a life and death situation, who would you save if you could only choose one? Who would you pull out of the freezing water first if the lifeboat only had a limited number of places? Your family. You always start with your family. That's what she tells herself. She's freezing. She turned up the heat and is wearing four layers, but she's still shaking. She's gone from room to room in the house. She's cleaned Kevin's room, has gotten rid of all the sheets and pillowcases, has dumped all the t-shirts and jeans from the washing basket into charity collection boxes many miles away from the house. She's vacuumed up all potential blouse buttons and flushed any traces of marijuana down the toilet. Because she's his mom. And that's where you start. When the police arrived, she was standing tall in the doorway. Their lawyers had pointed out that they could object, delay, make things difficult, that the search of the house and any forensic evidence could be deemed inadmissible given that the police only showed up a whole week after the alleged offense. But his mom insisted on letting in the men in uniform. She repeated time and time again that her family had nothing to hide, although she was unable to stop wondering if she was trying to convince them or herself. She can't stop shivering. But she's his mom. So where do you start, if not there? Kevin's dad is sitting in the kitchen, now the command center, making call after call, as more and more men gather in the house. They're all very understanding, sympathetic, angry. They are hurt, aggressive. They're ready for war. Not because they've chosen it, but because they don't believe they have a choice. Kevin's dad's childhood friend, Mario Litt, is the loudest of them all. "Do you know what? That girl's family could have come and talked to us. They could have tried to resolve this privately. But instead they waited a whole week, until the moment when they knew would do us the most harm. Then went to the police with their lies, immediately before the final. If it was actually true, why wasn't it reported at once? Why wait a week? Eh? Should I tell you why? Because some people in this town can't control their own jealousy." He could have called that girl's family by their name, Anderson, but that would have been less effective. He needn't have said anything more, because soon the theory is spreading on its own. This is what happens when you let a GM get too big for his boots, isn't it? We've given him too much influence. He thinks he owns the club. So now he can't handle the fact that he's losing his own power, right? And the fact that Kevin is better than he ever was, and the board and the sponsors are going against his wishes and demanding that David take over from soon as A-team coach, right? So now the GM is trying to drag his family into it. When David arrives at the house, there are three middle-aged men standing outside, as if on guard. Tonight, there will be players from the junior team there instead. David already knows that. As if the house needed protecting. "Looks like a scene from The Godfather," David mutters. Tails answers him. The big man looks embarrassed and therefore laughs a bit too loudly.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Like Don Corleone needs our help, as if a bunch of fat sponsors could make any real difference.
He chuckles and pats his own stomach, trying to appear nonchalant, but eventually gives up and puts a huge hand on David's shoulder, saying,
Oh, David, you know, we just want to support the family. You can understand that, can't you? We just want to show that we stand united. You can see that. I mean, no one knows Kevin better than you. Christ, you practically raised the boy. And do you think one of the boys on your team could do what he's been accused of? Hey, one of your own lads? You can understand why we're here, can't you?
David doesn't reply. That isn't his job. Not his place. Because who do you start with? If you really had to choose, who do you say first? Whose word do you believe? Kevin is sitting on his bed. He looks small beneath the posters on the wall. His hoodie looks too big for him. He's spent 2 nights in the police station. It doesn't matter how comfortable the bunk is or how friendly the staff is to you. When you hear the door lock from the outside before you go to bed, it does something to a person. That's what he tells himself, that he has no choice, that it isn't his fault, that this may not even have actually happened. His parents' house is full of men who have known him since he was a child. They know him. All his life he has been special, chosen, has been expected to do something out of the ordinary. So they don't believe this of him. How could they even entertain the possibility? They're not going to let him down. And if enough people stand behind you, you can start to believe almost anything that comes out of your mouth. That's what he tells himself. David closes the door behind him, stands in front of the bed, and looks the boy right in the eye. All the tens of thousands of hours they've spent on the ice together. All the weekends on the team bus, driving up and down the country, all the gas station sandwiches and poker parties. He was a child until recently. Until very recently.
Just look me in the eye and tell me you didn't do it. I'm not asking for anything else, David says.
And Kevin looks him straight in the eye, shakes his head as he cries, whispers with wet cheeks.
I slept with her because that's what she wanted. She asked me to. Ask anyone who was at the party.
Shit, Coach. Really? You seriously think I could rape someone? Why would I do that? All the fathers against sons days at the rink that David has spent down on the lake with Kevin and Benji. All that he's taught them. All that they've shared. Next year they'll be taking over the A-team, together. Who do you start with? If the water is freezing but you know the boat won't be able to carry everyone to the shore, who do you sacrifice first? Who do you protect unto the last? Kevin isn't the only one who'll suffer if he confesses. Everyone he loves will. That's what David tells himself. David sits on the boy's bed and hugs him, promises that everything will be okay, that he'll never let him down, that he's proud of him. The boat may be rocking, but it's not letting in water. All the feet in the house are dry. Kevin turns to his coach and whispers, like he was a primary school pupil again. The team are training today, aren't they? Can I come? On a stool in her bedroom sits a mother, thinking about a childhood. How she and her husband used to come home from trips abroad when Kevin was 10 or 11 and find the house in a complete mess. His father always swore, even though he never seemed to appreciate how calculated the chaos was, but his mom soon learned to understand the pattern. The same things had moved. The same pictures would be hanging crookedly. The bin full of prepared meals whose contents had obviously been opened at the same time. When Kevin became a teenager and started having parties, his mother started to come home to a house where the boy had obviously done all he could to make it look like he hadn't even been there. But before that, when he was little, when he proudly promised his dad that he wasn't scared of being on his own, he always had to come back on that last evening and mess up the whole house so that no one would know he had slept at Benji's the whole time. On a chair in his kitchen sits a father, and all around him his friends and business partners are talking. But he no longer hears the words. He knows he occupies his position in this town, his status among this group of men, purely because of his money.
None of these men play golf with poor guys. And he's been poor. All his life he has strived for perfection, not out of vanity, but as a survival strategy. He has never been given anything for free. He's never cut himself any slack, the way men who are born rich can. He's convinced that's the reason for his success, the fact that he's been prepared to work harder and fight more ruthlessly than everyone else. And continuing to hunt perfection in all things means never being satisfied, never resting on your laurels. You can't live that sort of life half the time. Your work and private life become the same thing. Everything in his life has become a reflection of him as a person. Even his son. Any crack in the facade could lead to an avalanche. He may have wanted to talk to Kevin when he picked him up from the police station, but every word came out as a roar. A man who takes great pride from the fact that he never loses his temper, never raises his voice, screaming so loudly that the car shook. He may have wanted to scream about what had happened, but it was easier to scream about why. How the hell could you let yourself get drunk a week before the final? It's easier to talk about a cause rather than a problem. For a dad who works with numbers, mathematics provides a more bearable explanatory model. If only X hadn't existed, Y never would have happened. If Kevin hadn't had a party despite promising his parents that he wouldn't, if he hadn't gotten drunk, if he hadn't taken a girl up to his room, then they wouldn't have had to deal with this problem. But now the father has no choice. He can't afford to let anyone tell lies about his son. He can't accept the idea of anyone attacking his family. When the police became involved, when they dragged Kevin off the bus in front of the whole town, when the reporters from the local paper started to call, that was when things passed the point where there could have been a peaceful solution. Now it's too late. The father has a business that consists of his name, and if that name gets sullied, it could destroy the entire life of the family. So he can't let them win. He can't even let them exist. It's not enough merely to hurt them. He has to hunt them down with every weapon he can find. There's no right or wrong in this house anymore. Just survival. David and Kevin are still sitting on the bed when Kevin's father opens the door. He stands in front of them, tired and pale, and explains in a very controlled voice, "I understand that you only want to think about hockey right now. But if you want there even to be an A team to coach and play in next season, you need to listen very carefully, now. Either the two of you stay at the club, or Peter Anderson does. There's no middle way. His daughter is lying. And there may be 1,000 reasons for that. Maybe she had sex because she's in love, and when she discovered that her feelings weren't reciprocated, she invented the story about rape. Maybe her dad found out and got angry, so she lied to protect herself because she wants to go on being daddy's innocent little girl. Who knows? 15-year-old girls aren't rational." David looks down at the floor. He can remember when Kevin was receiving offers from all the big teams but chose not to go, because he didn't want to leave Benji and his home, because he was scared. It was David who persuaded Kevin's dad to let him stay in Beartown. He promised that the boy would develop just as well here, would get to play on the A-team early, and would achieve even greater things once he did turn professional. His dad agreed because David was going to be A-team coach, and because the decision simultaneously made his company even more popular in the district. Kevin was a Beartown kid, his dad a Beartown man, and that looked good. His dad has invested a lot of money in that image. So now he points at Kevin and sternly says, "This isn't a game anymore. Peter Anderson waited a week before going to the police because he wanted the police to drag you off that bus. He wanted everyone to see that. So either he forces us out of this club, or we force him out. Together. There are no other options." David says nothing. He's thinking about his job, his team, all those hours. And one single memory refuses to leave him. He saw Peter in the parking lot when the police came to the bus. He saw him standing there waiting. Kevin's dad is right. Peter wanted to see it happen. Kevin lifts his head and snot and tears drip onto the floor when he says, "Someone needs to talk to Amit. I didn't do anything. You know I didn't do anything. But maybe Amit thinks. He came into the room and saw us. She just got scared, okay? She rushed out, but maybe Amit thinks, you know.
David doesn't look up, because he doesn't want to see the way the father is looking at the son. Chapter 38. There are damn few things in life that are harder than admitting to yourself that you're a hypocrite. Amit is walking along, half on the edge of the road and half in the ditch. He's wet and cold, and his brain went numb long before his feet. He's halfway between Head and Beartown when an old Saab drives past and stops 10 yards ahead of him. It waits for him as he walks slowly toward it. There are two men in their late 20s or early 30s sitting in the front seats. Black jackets, wary eyes. He knows who they are. He doesn't know which is more dangerous, looking them in the eye, or avoiding doing so. A few months ago, the local paper interviewed a player from a team that was due to play Beartown's A-team. The player came from the South. He didn't know any better. So when the reporter asked if he was frightened by the violent reputation of the Pack, the passionate supporters up in Beartown, he said he certainly wasn't frightened of a few forest gangsters from a dying town. When the team's bus was driving through the forest the next day, they found the road in front of them blocked by a couple of vans. Out of the trees stepped 30 or 40 masked men in black jackets, armed with tree branches. They stood there for 10 minutes, let the team on board prepare themselves for the moment when the door was smashed in and the bus invaded, but nothing happened. Suddenly the forest swallowed the men up again, the vans reversed out of the way, and the bus was allowed through. The player who had talked to the paper turned to an older player and gasped, "Why didn't they do anything?" The older player replied, "They were just introducing themselves. They want you to think about what they could do when the bus is going back the other way." Beartown lost the match, but the player who had talked to the paper played his worst ever match. When he got back to his own town, someone had already been there and smashed the windows of his car, filled it with branches and leaves, and set fire to it. "You're Amit, right?" the man in the driver's seat asks. The driver nods toward the back door. "Want a lift?" Amit doesn't know if it's more dangerous to say yes or no, but in the end he shakes his head. The men don't look insulted. The driver even smiles when he says, "Nice to have a bit of a walk, yeah?" "We get it." He puts the car in gear, slowly releases the clutch, but before it starts to move, he leans out of the window and adds, "We saw you play in the semifinal, Amit. You've got heart. When you and the other juniors make it to the A-team, we can build something really good around here again. A real Beartown team made up of real Beartown guys. You get it? You, Benji, Philip, Lit, Kevin." Amit knows that the expression on his face is being scrutinized by the men in the car when Kevin's name is mentioned. That this was the whole reason why they stopped. His chin moves quickly up and down. Their eyes meet very briefly. They know that he understands. They wish him a pleasant walk and pull away. Peter is sitting in his office, staring at a black computer screen. He's thinking about the right sort of guy. He said those words hundreds of times in hundreds of different rooms, and hundreds of men have nodded in agreement, even though he is certain that no one can explain exactly what they mean. It's a pointless term to use in hockey, because it suggests that who you are off the ice says something about who you are on it. And that's a difficult thing to acknowledge. Because if you love hockey, if you love anything, really, you'd really prefer it to exist inside a bubble, unaffected by anything happening outside. You want there to be one place, one single place, which will always be exactly the same, no matter how much the world outside might change. That's why Peter likes to say, "Hockey and politics don't belong together." When he said that during an argument with Kira a few years ago, his wife snorted and said, "No? What do you think gets rinks built, if not politics? Do you think it's only people who like hockey who pay taxes, then?" A few years ago, there was an incident at one of the A-team's away games. A Beartown player lost his temper and brought his stick down on the head of an opponent, a promising 20-year-old. He was ejected for the rest of the game, but escaped a longer suspension. When he left the ice and was on his way to the locker room, he was confronted by two men,
the assistant coach of the other team, and one of their sponsors. An argument and a clumsy fight ensued. The player hit the coach in the face with his glove, and the sponsor pulled the player's helmet off and tried to headbutt him before the player smashed his stick into the sponsor's knee and knocked him to the floor. No one suffered any serious injury, but the player was reported to the police and was fined several days' wages. As for the player who got hit in the head while on the ice during the game, the resulting concussion and neck injury ended his career. Peter remembers the incident because Kira brought it up again and again for the rest of the season. So when someone gets into a fight 3 yards from the ice, it's okay to report them to the police. But a minute and a half earlier, when the same man hits a 20-year-old over the head with a stick in the middle of a match, he just has to go and sit and feel embarrassed for a little while? Peter couldn't win against her, because he didn't want to say what he really felt. That he didn't think what had happened in the player's tunnel should have been reported to the police, either. Not because he liked violence, and not because he was in any way trying to defend what the player had done, but because he wanted hockey to solve hockey's problems. Inside the bubble. He's always felt that it's impossible to explain that to anyone who doesn't love hockey. Now he's no longer sure he can even convince himself. And he doesn't know what that says about him. Hypocrisy is a damn hard thing to admit. The club's president wipes his hands on his pants and feels the sweat trickling down the base of his spine. He spent all day talking on the phone, trying to put this off as long as possible, but he no longer has a choice. The threats of withdrawn sponsors' money and resigned memberships have grown too strong, and everyone is asking the same thing. Whose side are you really on? As if a hockey club is supposed to choose a side. The president is proud to represent a popular movement that is independent of ideologies, religions, and other faiths. He doesn't believe in God, but he does believe in hockey, and he believes in the unifying strength of a hockey club precisely because it only defines itself as a hockey club. The stands are unique. They contain rich and poor alike, high and low, right and left. And how many places like that does society have left? How many troublesome guys has hockey kept away from addiction and prison? How much money does hockey save society? How come everything bad that happens is hockey's problem, but everything good is thanks to something else? It drives the president mad that people don't appreciate how much work goes on behind the scenes. You need more diplomacy here than in the headquarters of the United Nations. The phone rings again. 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 In the end, he stands up and goes out into the hallway, where he tries to breathe normally in spite of the pressure in his chest. Then he goes and stands in the doorway to Peter's office and says quietly, "Maybe you should go home, Peter, until this blows over." Peter sits on his chair without looking at him. He's already packed his things away in boxes, hasn't even switched his computer on. He's just been waiting. "Is that what you think? Or are you just scared about what other people think?" The president frowns. "For God's sake, Peter, you know perfectly well that I think this whole situation is terrible. Just terrible. What your daughter is going through is..." Peter stands up. "Maya. You can say her name. You come to her birthday party every year. You taught her to ride a bike, do you remember? Right here, in front of the rink. I'm just trying..." "Please, Peter. The board is just trying to handle this responsibly." Peter's eyebrows quiver. That's the only physical sign of the unbearable firestorm raging inside him. "Responsibly? Let me guess. The board would rather we had dealt with this internally. That we hadn't involved the police and the media and just looked each other in the eye and talked about it. Is that more or less what people have been telling you over the phone today? It was rape. How do you deal with that internally?" When Peter picks up his boxes and walks out into the hallway, the president gets out of the way, then clears his throat unhappily and says, "It's her word against his, Peter. We have to think of the team first. You of all people ought to understand that. The club can't take a position on this." Peter doesn't turn around when he replies. "The club has taken a position. It just did." He dumps his boxes in the back of his car, but leaves it in the parking lot. He walks slowly through the town without knowing where he's going.
The school headmaster hardly has time to put the phone down before it rings again. Voice after voice, parent after parent. What answers do they want? What do they expect? This is a police matter. Let the courts decide. As if running a school isn't hard enough. The girl's mother is a lawyer. The boy's father, one of the most powerful men in the entire district. One person's word against another's. Who'd want to get in the middle of that? That can't be the task of the school, surely. So the headmaster says the same thing again, over and over again, to everyone. Please, let's not make this political. Whatever you do, don't make this political. One advantage of having a brother who works for the security company is that all her nocturnal outings as a result of false alarms have given Jeanette a specialist's knowledge of the architecture of the school. For instance, she knows where on the top floor to find the small cubbyhole containing the narrow staircase that the chimney sweeps once used to reach the roof. And up there, behind an air vent just above the dining room, a teacher can have a cigarette without being spotted by either the headmaster or any students. And that's needed more on some days than others. That's how Jeanette happens to see Benji walking across the schoolyard just after lunch. All the other players in the junior team are playing truant to be with Kevin. So the fact that Benji is here of his own volition can only mean that he's looking for the opposite. Anna is sitting alone in a classroom full of students who are talking about nothing but Maya and Kevin. Maya is sitting alone in another classroom where no one is talking at all. She sees the notes they pass across each other's desks, the phones they conceal on their laps. She will always be this to them now. At best, the girl who got raped. At worst, the girl who lied. They will never let her be anyone but that. In every room, on every street, in the supermarket, and at the rink, she will walk in like an explosive device. They will be scared to touch her, even the ones who believe her, because they don't want to risk getting hit by shrapnel when she detonates. They will back away in silence, turn in a different direction. They will wish that she would just disappear, that she had never been here. Not because they hate her, because they don't, not all of them. They don't all scrawl bitch on her locker. They don't all rape her. They aren't all evil. But they're all silent, because that's easier. She gets up in the middle of the class and leaves the room without a word of protest from her teacher. She crosses an empty hallway, goes into a bathroom, stands in front of the mirror, and smashes her fist into it as hard as she can. The glass shatters, and it takes a few seconds for the pain to reach her brain, and she has time to see the blood before it actually hurts. Benji sees her go in. He does his best to persuade himself to go in the other direction. Keep quiet. Don't get involved. But then he hears the crash and the tinkling sound as pieces of glass hit the porcelain sink, and he's broken enough mirrors himself to recognize the noise. He knocks on the door. When she doesn't answer, he says, "I can kick it in, or you can unlock it. Your choice." She's standing there with toilet paper wrapped clumsily around her knuckles. It's slowly turning red. Benji closes the door behind him, nods toward the mirror. 7 years bad luck. Perhaps Maya ought to be frightened, but she hasn't got the energy. She can't even be bothered to feel hate. She doesn't feel anything at all. Hardly makes any difference to me now, does it? Benji sticks his hands in his pockets. They stand in silence, the victim and the best friend. The bitch and the brother. Maya clears her throat to stifle her sobs and says, "I don't care what you want. I get that you hate me. You think I'm lying to get your best friend in trouble. But you're wrong. You're fucking wrong." Benji takes his hands out of his pockets, carefully picks some pieces of glass out of the sink, and drops them, one by one, into the trash. "You're the one who's wrong." "Screw you," Maya hisses, and moves toward the door, and the boy slips nimbly out of the way so she doesn't have to come into physical contact with him. And only much later will she realize what a considerate gesture that was. Benji utters the words so quietly that at first she thinks she's misheard. "You're the one who's wrong, Maya, because you think he's still my best friend." Jeanette has an hour between lessons. She takes the opportunity to go to the bathroom to wash the smell of cigarettes off her fingers while the hallway is empty. She stops when she sees Maya come out, in tears and with her knuckles bleeding as if she smashed something. The girl doesn't see the teacher, just runs off in the other direction, toward the exit. The next moment, the washroom explodes with noise as a sink is torn from the wall and thrown to the floor. A toilet is kicked to pieces, a trash can thrown straight through the window. It doesn't take long for the hallway to fill with adults and pupils, but by then everything inside the bathroom has already been systematically smashed and demolished. It takes one headmaster, one caretaker, and two gym teachers to grab hold of Benji and get him out of the bathroom. The school will describe this later as an emotional outburst from a student with a well-documented history of problems with aggression. They will say that it is understandable, considering his relationship to the boy who had been accused of, you know. Jeanette stands and stares at the wreckage, meets Benji's gaze, and watches as he is led away. The boy smashed up an entire bathroom and accepted both suspension and liability for the cost of repairs without blinking. All because he didn't want anyone to know that Maya had smashed a mirror. He decided that she had already bled enough. The only adult who will know this is Jeanette, and she will never say anything. She knows a thing or two about keeping secrets herself. She goes back up onto the roof, smokes the rest of the pack. Kira is in her office, buried in printouts of previous judgments and precedents from sexual assault cases, in constant discussion with her colleagues, total mobilization for war. She is feeling everything all at the same time. Rage, grief, impotence, a desire for vengeance, hatred, terror. Yet it still falls away from her in an instant when her phone vibrates and her daughter's name illuminates the screen. Four little words. Can you come home? Never has a mother driven a car faster through that forest. Maya is sitting on the floor of the bathroom at home, rinsing the blood from her hand before finally collapsing altogether. Everything she has held back, everything she has tried to stifle, everything she has tried not to show in order to protect the people she loves, to stop them having to feel as much pain as her. She can't bear their pain as well. She can't handle the weight of other people's sorrow on top of this. I didn't want the bastards to see me bleed, she whispers to her mother. Sometimes I'm afraid that they're going to have to understand that you're a real person, her mother sobs, clutching her daughter so very, very tightly in her arms. Chapter 39. What is a community? Amit sees it from a long way off. No one in the Hollow has such an expensive car, and no one who has such an expensive car drives to the Hollow voluntarily. The man gets out, self-assured and straight-backed. Hi there, Amit. Do you know who I am? Amit nods. You're Kevin's dad. Kevin's dad smiles. Looks at Amit. He sees the boy glance at his watch and presumes that he's trying to figure out how many months of his mom's wages one like it would cost. The man remembers what he was like at that age, when he didn't have a damn thing and hated anyone who did. Can we have a little chat, Amit? Just you and me, man to man. Tails is sitting in his office at one end of the supermarket. His chair creaks beneath his bulky frame as he rests his forehead on his palm. The voice on the phone is unhappy, but not sympathetic. It's nothing personal, Tails. But you must see that we can't build a hockey academy in Beartown after all this. We can't let the media make it look like we... you know. The man on the phone is a local counselor, Tails an entrepreneur, but they're also two boys who used to play hockey together down on the lake. Sometimes their conversations are on the record, sometimes off, and today's is floating somewhere in between the two. I have a responsibility to the council, Tails, and to the party. You can understand that, surely. Tails understands. He's always been a man who believed in difficult questions and simple answers. What's a business? It's an idea. What's a town? A collection of individuals. What's money? Possibilities. Behind his back, on the other side of the wall, someone is banging with a hammer. Tails is expanding his supermarket because growth means survival. An entrepreneur who isn't moving isn't actually standing still,
He's going backward. I've got to go, Tails. I've got a meeting, the voice on the phone says apologetically. A phone hangs up. An idea is gone. A hockey academy no longer exists. What does that mean? When Tails was young, there were 3 schools in Beartown. Now there's 1. Once the hockey academy has been built in Head, how long will it be before the council shuts the last school here? And when the best juniors from here train in the rink in Head all day, it will be only natural for them to play in Head's A-team in the evenings. When Beartown's A-team can't recruit the best youngsters in the area, the club will collapse. The rink won't be renovated. There won't be any new employment opportunities, which would have been a natural step toward other developments. A conference center, a shopping mall, a new industrial estate, better links to the freeway, maybe even an airport. What's a hockey club? Maybe Tails is a hopeless romantic. His wife often says he is. But to him, a hockey club is what makes everyone in this town remember, once a week, all the things they have in common instead of what divides them. The club is proof that they can work together to become something greater. It teaches them to dream. He believes in difficult questions and simple answers. What happens to a town that doesn't grow? It dies. Peter comes into the store. Everyone sees him, but no one does. Staff and customers, young and old, his childhood friends and neighbors, they all slide away as he approaches, disappear behind shelves and into aisles, pretending to be absorbed in their shopping lists and comparing prices. Only one man looks straight at him. Tails stands in the doorway to his office, meets Peter's gaze. What is a GM? What is a team captain? What is a childhood friend? Tails puts one foot hesitantly in front of the other, opens his mouth as if to say something. But Peter merely shakes his head slowly. He will never know that his daughter shook her head at Anna in the school dining room because she didn't want the hatred directed at her to hit her friend. But he does the same thing here. And when he goes back inside his office and closes the door, Tails' shame is the same shame all friends feel when they fall short. People are good at feeling shame in this town. They start training early. Kevin's dad doesn't wait for an answer, just rubs his hands and chuckles. Still cold in March. I never get used to it. Shall we sit in the car? Ahmet sits in the seat in silence, closes the door as if he's afraid it might break. The car smells of leather and perfume. Kevin's dad looks at the blocks of apartments. I grew up in a block that looked almost exactly like these. I think maybe mine was one story smaller. Your dad doesn't live with you, does he? He asks the questions directly, without any complication. The same way he conducts all his business. He died in the war, just after I was born, Ahmet replies, blinking more quickly. The man notices even though he's not facing him. My mom was on her own, too. Me and 3 brothers. The hardest job on the planet, isn't it? Your mom's got trouble with her back, hasn't she? Ahmet tries to hide it, but the man sees his eyebrows twitch. So he goes on, sensitively. I know a good physiotherapist. I can arrange for her to get seen. That would be very nice of you, the boy murmurs, without making eye contact. The man holds out his hands briefly. I'm actually surprised that no one else has already helped her with that. Someone who works at the club ought to have asked how she was, surely, don't you think? She's been working there long enough, hasn't she? Since we moved here, Ahmet admits. We're supposed to look after each other in this town, Ahmet, don't you think? In our town and our club, we take care of each other, the man says, handing him a business card. Is this the physiotherapist's number? Ahmet asks. No, that's the number of the personnel manager of a business in Head. Tell your mom to call and arrange an interview. Office work, no cleaning. Light admin, filing, that sort of thing. She knows the language well enough? Ahmet nods a little too quickly, a little more eagerly than he would have liked. Yes, yes, of course. Well then, just call that number, Kevin's dad says. Then he says nothing for a long time, as if that were the whole purpose of his visit. What is a PAC? Nothing, if you ask its members. It doesn't exist. The men sitting around the tables in the bearskin have nothing in common apart from the fact that they're men. The oldest are over 40, the youngest not even able to vote. Some have the bear tattooed on their necks, others on their arms, many not at all. Some have good jobs, others bad jobs, many no job at all. Some have families, children, mortgages, and go on package holidays. And some live alone and have never set foot outside Beartown. That is precisely the problem when the police try to identify them as the pack. They only have something in common when you see them together. As soon as they're a few feet away from each other, they're just individuals. And what is a club? If you ask them, it belongs to them. Not the old bastards, the men who wear smart jackets to games, the sponsors and board members and president and GM. They're all the same. In a single season, all those old bastards could disappear, but the club would still be there. The pack, too. It's a thing that doesn't exist and always exists. They're not always threatening. Rarely violent, unless it's a match day and there are opposing fans in the vicinity. But they make a point of showing the old bastards who the club really belongs to every now and then. And what happens if you jeopardize its survival. Ramona is standing behind the bar. The men in black jackets are sitting at her tables. They're the most considerate lads she knows. They buy her food and put in new bulbs up in the apartment without her even having to ask. When she once asked why they hate Peter so much, their eyes darkened, and one of them replied, "Because that fucker never had to fight for hockey. He got it all on a plate. So he's frightened. The sponsors have got him on a leash. He puts their fucking logos ahead of what's best for the club. Everyone knows he grew up in the standing section, but when the sponsors want to drive out those of us standing there now and replace us with the fucking hot dogs and coke audience, he doesn't say a word. Everyone knows he loves Soon like a father and that he doesn't want David to be A-team coach, but he just keeps his mouth shut. What sort of man is that? How can we let him be GM of our club?" Ramona fixed her eyes on them and hissed, "And what about you, then? How many people in this town would dare to disagree with you? Do you think that means you're right? Every single fucking time?" They fell silent then. Ramona could, perhaps, have been proud of that, if it weren't for the fact that through the small windows facing the street, she now sees Peter walking along, slowly, as if he doesn't know where he's going. He stops and looks in through the window with a bag of groceries in his hand, hesitating. Ramona could have gone out and gotten him, offered him a cup of coffee. It would have been so simple. But she looks around her inside the bearskin at the men at the tables, and the only thing that is simpler than offering Peter coffee in this town right now is not doing so. How big is the world when you're 12 years old? Both infinite and infinitesimal. It's all your wildest dreams, but it's also a cramped locker room in an ice rink. Leo is sitting on a bench. The front of his jersey has a large bear on it. No one is looking at him, but everyone is. His best friends get up and move to another bench when he sits down. He doesn't get a single pass all session. He wishes someone had checked him. He wishes they'd thrown his clothes in the shower. He almost wishes that they'd shouted something horrible about his sister, just to escape the silence. Ahmet's fingers can't stop feeling the edge of the business card. Kevin's dad looks at the time as if he's in a hurry to leave and smiles at Ahmet as if they're done. Ahmet even has time to reach for the door handle before the man pats him paternally on the shoulder and says, as if the thought has only just occurred to him, "By the way, at the party, my son's party, I know you think you might have seen something that night, Ahmet. But I think you also know that an awful lot of people saw how much alcohol you drank at that party, right?" The quivering business card betrays how much she is shaking. Kevin's dad puts his hand on his. "You can get so many ideas in your head when you've been drinking, Ahmet, but that doesn't mean that they're true. People do stupid things when they're drunk. Trust me, I've done plenty." The man laughs warmly and self-deprecatingly. Ahmet is still staring at the business card. The name of a personnel manager. A big company. A different life. "Are you in love with Maya?" The man asks so abruptly that Ahmet nods before he has time to think.
It's the first time he's admitted it to anyone. Tears are pricking the backs of his eyelids. The man is still holding his fingers gently and says,
"She's put you in a terrible situation. You and Kevin. A goddamn terrible situation. And do you think she cares about you, Amit? Do you think she would have done this if she did? It's hard for you to understand now, but girls need attention in a different way than boys. And they do goddamn weird things to get it. Little girls gossip and spread rumors, but men don't. Men look each other in the eye and sort things out without involving everyone else. Don't you think?" Amit glances at him, bites his lip and nods. Kevin's dad leans over confidentially and whispers, "That girl chose Kevin. But believe me, there'll soon come a time when she'll wish she'd picked you instead. When you're playing in the A-team, when you turn professional, the girls will flock to you. And then you'll understand that some of them can't be trusted. They're like a virus." Amit sits in silence, feeling the weight of the man's hand on his shoulder. "Is there anything you want to tell me, Amit?" The boy shakes his head. Sweat from his fingers is starting to stain the business card. The man takes out his wallet and hands him 5,000-kroner notes. "I heard you might need new skates. From now on, whenever you need anything, you can just call me. We take care of each other. In this town and on this team." Amit takes the money and folds the notes around the business card, opens the door, and gets out. The man rolls down his window and calls, "I know that tonight's training session is voluntary, but it would be good if you were there. The team needs to stick together, right? People are nothing when they're alone in this world, Amit." The boy promises to go. The man laughs, pretends to be angry, and frowns, hunches his shoulders, and growls, "Because we are the bears from Beartown." The expensive car turns around and disappears out onto the road. A considerably cheaper car is parked at the other end of the parking lot, an old Saab with its hood open. Its owner, a young man in a black jacket with a bear tattooed on his neck, is leaning over it, tinkering with the engine. He pretends not to notice either the expensive car or the boy it leaves behind in front of the apartment blocks, but when Kevin's dad has gone, Amit drops something in the snow. The boy stands for a long time, staring down, as if he were trying to decide whether to pick it up again. In the end, he wipes his face with the back of his hand and disappears into one of the stairwells. The young man waits a minute before leaving the Saab and going over to pick up the 5,000-kroner notes from the ground. They're crumpled from having been clenched in a sweaty palm. The man puts them in the pocket of his black jacket. Amit closes the door of the apartment behind him, looks at the business card, hides it in his room, and fetches his skates. They're too small, and so worn that the paint is peeling off them. He knows exactly what sort he could buy with 5,000 kroner. All the children in the hollow know the price of things they can't afford. He packs his bag and goes out, runs down the stairs, opens the door. The money's gone. He will never be able to say for sure if that made him feel disappointed or relieved. Peter is standing on a quiet street. He can see the roof of the rink from here. What is a home? It's a place that belongs to you. So can it still be your home if you're no longer welcome there? He doesn't know. He will talk to Kira this evening. She'll say, "I can get a job anywhere," and Peter will nod, even though he can't get a job anywhere. They will talk about moving, and he will decide seriously to try to live without hockey. He doesn't notice, but when he starts walking again, an old Saab drives past him. Kira is taking the trash out. That's her daughter's job. They agreed on that when she got her guitar, but things are different now. Not even the summer will help cure her daughter's fear of the dark. There's a smell of fresh coffee coming from their neighbor's window. God, how Kira used to sigh about all the coffee when the family moved to Beartown. "Coffee, coffee, coffee. Don't people do anything but drink coffee here?" she grumbled to Peter, and Peter shrugged and said, "They just want to show that they'd like to be your friends. It's hard to say, 'Can I be your friend?' It's much easier to say, 'Would you like coffee?'" This is a town where people, well, I don't really know how to explain it. A town where people believe in difficult questions and simple answers. Kira got used to it. All the things they expressed with a drink in this place in the forest. Whenever they wanted to say, thanks, or sorry, or I'm right there with you, they would say, would you like coffee, or can I get you a beer, or two shots, please, on my tab. Kira drops the garbage in the bin. There are lights on in the neighbor's windows. No one opens the door. David leads the team out of the locker room, out of the rink. They're training in the forest this evening. He gets them to do push-ups, and no one fights harder than Bobo. The boy who may not even get to play hockey next season. He's too old for the juniors and too bad for the seniors, but he's here of his own accord, sweating blood. David gets them to run, and Philip comes in first every time. Next season will be his biggest, the year when everyone else sees how good he really is. They will say that he is an overnight success. Sure, it's only taken all his time since he was 5 years old. Only taken everything he and his mom had. Overnight. Christ. It's only taken his whole life. David gets them to play tug-of-war, and Lit almost dislocates his shoulder trying to win. And Amit? He doesn't say a word to anyone, but he completes every exercise, does everything asked of him. The club's president is standing at the edge of the forest, close enough to see but far enough away not to be easily spotted. He's sweating. When the big car stops down in the parking lot in front of the rink and Kevin and his dad get out, it's the first time anyone has ever seen his dad attend a training session. Kevin is already in his equipment and jogs toward his team in the forest, and the cheers ring out among the trees as they greet him like a king. The president remains standing on the edge of the tree line as David stands in the middle of his boys and shakes Kevin's dad's hand. The president's eyes meet those of the coach across the distance, just for a moment. Then the president turns and goes back to his office. If Kevin had come into the rink, the club would have been forced to talk about principles and consequences. The president might have had to ask him to go home, just until this blows over. But he can't stop the boys from training in the forest. That's what they all tell themselves. In another part of town, outside a house in the Heights, Kevin's mom takes the garbage out. She looks gray, from exhaustion as much as anything else, but new makeup has hidden the signs of crying. She opens the bin, her back straight, her gaze fixed. There are lights on in the windows all around. A door opens. A voice calls out to her. Would you like to come over for coffee? Another door opens in the next house. Then another. Then another. Difficult questions. Simple answers. What is a community? It is the sum total of our choices. Chapter 40. There's an old saying that Soon loves. What do you call it when a man goes out into the forest and other men follow him? Leadership. What do you call it when a man goes out into the forest alone? A walk. Peter walks into the house, puts the milk in the fridge, the bread on the countertop, drops the car keys in a bowl. Only then does he remember that he's left the car outside the rink. He wonders calmly if he's going to find it burned out tomorrow, full of charred branches. He picks up the keys, removes the key ring they're attached to, puts the keys back in the bowl, and drops the key ring in the garbage. Kira comes into the kitchen, stands on top of his feet, and he dances slowly, whispering in his wife's ear. We can move. You can get a job anywhere. But you can't, darling. You can't just get another job in hockey somewhere else. He knows. He knows that all too well. But he's never been more certain of anything than when he says, you moved here for me. I can move away from here for her. Kira holds his face in the palms of her hands. She sees his car keys in the bowl. For as long as she's known him, all his keys have been on a bear-shaped key ring.
Not anymore. Anna is sitting on her bed. The room no longer feels like it's hers. When her mom was at her angriest, when she was most hurt that her daughter hadn't moved with her after the divorce, she said Anna was a classic case of codependency. That she was staying for her dad's sake because she knew he wouldn't manage without her. Maybe it was true. Anna doesn't know. She's always wanted to be close to him, not because he understood her, but because he understood the forest. That was her big adventure, and no one knew more about that than he did. There was no better hunter in the whole of Beartown than her dad. As a child, she would lie awake in bed at night with her clothes on, hoping that the phone would ring. Whenever there was a car accident involving a wild animal anywhere in the district, which happened fairly regularly in winter, and the driver informed the police that the animal had disappeared into the forest, injured, it was Anna's dad who they called. His stubbornness and obstinacy and taciturnity were poor qualities in life, but perfect in the forest. "The pair of you can just sit here for the rest of your lives then, never saying a word," her mom yelled when she left. So they did. They just didn't see anything wrong with it, that's all. Anna has very clear memories of always nagging her dad to take her with him at night when she was little, but she never got her way. It was always too dangerous, too late at night, too cold, and she knew that meant he had been drinking. Her dad always trusted his daughter in the forest, but not himself. Audrey is going around the kennels feeding the dogs. She can see Benji in the gym in the outbuilding. His crutches are on the floor while he's on the bench press. He's lifted ridiculous amounts of weight this evening, even allowing for the fact that he's her crazy brother. She knows that the team is having a voluntary training session today. She heard in town that they were out running in the forest, and that Kevin was there too. But she doesn't ask Benji why he'd rather be alone. She doesn't want to be that sort of nagging sister. She may not have been born here, but she's still a Beartown girl. As tough as the forest, as hard as the ice. Work hard. Keep your mouth shut. Anna is standing naked in front of the mirror in her room, counting. She's always been good at that. Top grades in math all her life. When she was little, she used to count everything. Stones, blades of grass, trees in the forest, tracks on the ground, empty bottles in the cupboard under the sink, freckles on Maya's skin, even breaths. Sometimes, when she felt really bad, she counted scars. But mostly she just counted faults. She would stand in front of the mirror and point at them, all the things that were wrong about her. Sometimes that made it feel more bearable, when she had already said them out loud to herself before anyone at school did. Her dad knocks on her door. He hasn't done that in years. Since her mom left, father and daughter have had separate apartments, separate lives. She quickly gets dressed and opens the door in surprise. He's standing in the hall looking bewildered. Not drunk bewildered. Not the sad, lonely man who used to sit up all night. He's sober now. He reaches out his hand without touching her, as if he no longer knows how to say he cares. He says the words slowly. "I spoke to some of the guys on the hunting team. The hockey clubs called its members to a meeting. There's a group of parents and sponsors who are demanding a vote about Peter."
"About Peter?"
Anna repeats, because the meaning of the words isn't sinking in. "They're going to demand that the club fire him."
"What? Why?"
"The police weren't called in until a week after the party. Some people are saying that what happened is..." He can't say the word rape in front of his daughter. Doesn't want her to see how relieved and happy he is that it wasn't her. Scared that she'll hate him for that. Anna's fists hit the edge of the bed.
"A lie? They're saying it's a lie? And now they think Peter waited a week to report it to the police because he wanted to get at Kevin? As if Kevin's the goddamn victim here?"
Her dad nods. He stands in the doorway for so long without knowing what to say that all he eventually comes out with is, "I've made elk burgers. They're in the kitchen." He shuts the door behind him and goes back downstairs. Anna calls Maya 100 times that evening. She can understand why she's not getting any answer. Knows Maya hates her. Because precisely what did Maya predict? This. If she had